For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very, very grateful to have sitting opposite me in the WGTD studios this morning our good friend, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country, and who is also a frequent visitor to WUWM, our public radio neighbors to the north in Milwaukee. And we're grateful that he is also a monthly visitor to the morning show and has been so for over two decades, I think, by now. And Professor Sear's timing is propitious in that, of course, as all of you well know, the situation has somewhat exploded between Russia and Ukraine. And so we're going to be talking about that quite a lot. But there are some other interesting things Professor Sear has recently written about that we'll be talking about as well, including Canada-U.S. relations and a couple of different columns he has written concerning inflation, and also some thoughts that he recently shared that I very much appreciated about our own electoral college. So there's a lot to get to, and Professor Sear, Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, sir, and thank you for the kind invitation, as always. Unfortunately, timely.
Right, it sure is. I really appreciated the column that you wrote about a month ago, I think now, in which you really kind of outlined what I did not understand until then was a kind of a complicated relationship history between Russia and Ukraine. And I have a feeling I'm not alone in being vaguer than I should be in terms of exactly Russia and Ukraine's relationship over the last century or so. Before we touch on the current unfortunate conflict, maybe you could give our listeners at least a sketch summary of that history that you summarized in your column, I thought, so effectively.
Historically, not for 100 years, but for more like 1,000 years, Russia has understandably been concerned about inherently vulnerable, in some contrast to this country, through most of our history, inherently vulnerable Western borders, greatly reinforced by the invasion by the French under Napoleon early in the 19th century, as well as, of course, Barbarossa, the enormous, gigantic, extraordinarily costly invasion by the Wehrmacht, Adolf Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union in late June of 1941. The national grouping, the territory, Ukraine, was under Russian sovereignty traditionally. And Ukrainians, who are a distinctive ethnic group, the biggest problem for the Soviet Union, aside from the inherent weakness of communism and its self-defeating tendencies ultimately, was trying to hold all these different nationalities under a general Russian umbrella. The Ukrainians took advantage of the Russian Revolution in 1917, which was initially a democratic revolution with a small d, our kind of revolution, you might say, to break away. The Soviet Union, once Stalin and associates solidified control after the death of Lenin, the great revolutionary leader who established the communist state, with a very heavy hand, they reabsorbed Ukraine into the new Soviet Union. But there is a history of separatism and some independence that's very germane to the current situation.
So when the Soviet Union fell was it 90 or 91?
Yes.
That's when Ukraine managed to become newly independent.
Right, exactly.
And I suppose ever since then, or maybe especially under Mr. Putin, Russia's had its eye on trying to reabsorb Ukraine again.
One of his consistent ambitions, you're absolutely right, and he tends to be consistent in his strategic view, has been to reestablish the greatness of Imperial Russia, not communism. And Putin has been very careful, quite wisely, to make clear that communism is a thing of the past. In fact, he has formally committed to the Eastern Orthodox Church, I think primarily for political reasons, and he has been able to stabilize, reintegrate, and strengthen religion in Russia. But he, again, reflecting long-term anxieties as well as ambitions in Russia, long predating communism, he's really had his eye on territories like Ukraine and nations now today, like Ukraine and Georgia in particular.
So what Mr. Putin, if we were to pose the question, what does Mr. Putin want? Why does he want Ukraine? Do you think the primary reason is, in a sense, the safety and security of Russia to, in a sense, create some kind of cushion against other forces to the West?
Yes, exactly. And from my point of view, we should all make up our own minds as Americans, but from my point of view, we have been extraordinarily misguided, starting with the Clinton administration in trying to encourage expansion of the European Union, and in particular the NATO alliance right up to Russia's borders. It started under Clinton. It became far more aggressive for a time under the George W. Bush administration, with efforts to include Georgia as well as Ukraine in the NATO alliance. And that led, of course, directly to Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008. Extremely misguided policies from my point of view.
To expand NATO?
Oh, yeah. No.
You see that as
we're on
like
the radio, so I'm going to restrain my more colorful language inclination. No, it's just talk about arrogance and imperialism. And the Bush 2 people in particular, and this is not just professorial 2020 hindsight, I was alarmed throughout that administration by their behavior. Invasion of Iraq was the worst blunder, but this effort to expand NATO right up to Russia's borders,
that was
big mistake.
A provocative act.
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting because it could easily be sort of veiled in other terms as not a provocative act, but when in fact that's really what it was.
Yeah, Junior G.W., George W. Bush, became quite talented at this broad rhetoric, often referring to Christianity as well as democratic values, makes no sense in the real world of nation states, in great contrast to his father, who I believe was a very, very great president during a particularly challenging time, at the end of the Cold War and disintegration of the Soviet Union. At a more practical level, that everyone can understand, and not just us theoretical academic types, allegedly. The Ukraine is often referred to as a breadbasket of Europe and the global, now very global, agricultural economy. And I'm sure the food resources and other physical resources of Ukraine, given the fact that Russia is a failing state, politically as well as economically, demographically, there are very tangible physical incentives to lead Putin to put the Russian army into Ukrainian territory.
Some desperation there.
There is desperation, and his cool demeanor tends to hide that. This is a man with a lot of problems.
Right.
Very rich and very powerful, but believe me, no American wants to trade places with this guy, not just for moral reasons, but he's got no shortage of headaches. And this is partly an act of desperation.
Right.
Thank you.
One of the things you said in your column that was intriguing is you made reference to polls in Russia. Opinion
yes.
polls in Russia that show Putin's popularity in decline. And first of all, that's a somewhat remarkable thing, given his political durability. But the other thing, as you point out, is just the fact that there are opinion polls in Russia
yes.
is in and of itself kind of an extraordinary thing. But is it because of the difficulty of life in Russia that is that what is leading to Putin's plunging popularity?
I think that's a big part of it, the endless economic problems. And this is not the 20th century. It's not the first half of the 20th century where even in industrial nations it was possible for the state to close off the population from the outside world and exercise very direct and fearful control. The upside of the internet and global communications, we're all aware of the downsides, but you can't keep them down on the farm and you can't keep them complacent when the average person is getting all kinds of misinformation, but also good information, and the inevitable lure of consumerism, materialism, all the bad things about capitalism, allegedly, that good communists rejected, except for the people at the top who lived quite well. Also, there's a lot of resentment of the fact that this is a kleptocracy, and people are increasingly aware of just how luxuriously Putin and his gang, and that's what they are, live.
Hmm. One thing you say about Mr. Putin, you say Putin generally plays his strategic cards well. He's made some good, smart moves over the years, and at least in terms of his own interest and Russia's interest. But you say, however, his hand remains weak. So in terms of the cards he has with which to play, it's not a great hand. And I suppose you're again pointing to the really bleak economic situation there.
Yes. Plus the fact there seems to be increasing dissonance and disagreement, even among very senior government officials. Mind you, it's extraordinary. He deserves a lot of credit from saving Russia on, I believe, New Year's Eve, 1999, as we entered the new century. Russia was in a free fall economically, increasing social chaos and anarchy. And Putin's tremendous leadership ability, political and organizational skill, is reflected in the fact that he and his immediate associates were able to pull back from the abyss. But there is currently disagreement. It's common in the media and elsewhere to compare Putin and Stalin as these fearsome, dominant leaders. But he really reminds me at this point more of Nikita Khrushchev, who was throughout his turbulent tenure as leader of the Soviet Union from the time he solidified his control around the mid-50s till he was abruptly ousted in 64. He was constantly dealing with factional disagreements. I was trying to catch up early this morning and saw, before coming here and doing a little frantic homework, and there was a public disagreement in a video conference, which somehow got out, unless it's totally bogus, which I doubt, between Putin, in effect, publicly slapping down his chief of intelligence.
Wow.
Who was at a separate meeting, who was talking about the importance of the diplomatic route. Unless the whole thing is bogus and staged, again, which I doubt, it shows just how challenged he is.
Wow. Yeah, and you're right. And that really flies in the face of the assumption that a lot of us make about who is Putin and how powerful is he.
Yes, indeed. The Russians, I don't minimize, believe me, the commitment and sacrifice of our military and the commitment of Americans as a people, basically, to our institutions, including our fine military. But we, especially with the end of the military draft, our military is a segregated institution. And thank God we have not had very costly wars for us since Vietnam. And Russians live in a different world. It's like World War II was yesterday. Mm. And this was true during the Cold War, and it's been true since. Even younger people are very much aware of the horrific total war. I mean, this was a war to the death without any restraint on both sides, in considerable contrast to the Western Front until near the end of World War II. And people are not anxious to go to war in that country, mm-hmm. except the most fanatical.
Right. Well, they have indeed invaded Ukraine, and of course, the Western powers are now poised to try to respond in some way. And of course, what is seems to be at the forefront of consideration are sweeping and what, from the sounds of it, would be really severe sanctions against Russia, including some that would, if I understand correctly, would potentially remove Russia from much of the world's banking system. I mean, trying to sequester them even more than they already are. What do you make of those possibilities, and what effect do you think they could potentially have on this situation?
You're absolutely right. This invasion has really been ideal, in a sense, for bringing about pretty complete and strong unity, including very cautious contemporary Germany in the Western Allies. And we, especially since the 1970s, live in a fully integrated global banking system. Russia and the Soviet Union always had a central bank, but they were by design not part of the international financial system. Stalin very explicitly rejected Marshall Plan aid, which was offered to the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe after World War II, and the Soviet Union, very explicitly rejected participation in the Bretton Woods economic institutions, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the predecessor to the WTO, and the World Bank. They're now fully participating in these institutions. The central bank in Russia is run by a very capable economist, a woman I should note, who is also a very close ally of Putin. And they're not independent in the way that our Fed is independent, but they're also very much part of the international financial system. So these sanctions can be severe. They're necessary. It's conceivable that if things really get a lot worse in Russia, that the regime will collapse. We shouldn't hope and pray for that, because I'm convinced that if Putin does go down, which is a real possibility, the alternative is not going to be some sort of Russian-speaking Barack Obama, and we Americans tend to think everybody really wants to be like us.
Yeah, right.
No, it'll be a much more some of these extreme nationalists have emerged and pop up on the internet and on TV. Pay attention to these guys. It's a scary crew, and I believe a far more reckless population than Putin and his cronies have been.
Right. One thing that I've heard some people remark about is that at the opening of the Beijing Olympics, of course,
yes.
Mr. Putin was there.
Right.
At those opening ceremonies as if to try to demonstrate to the world some kind of friendship and or partnership between Russia and China. Do you know of anything in terms of anything substantial there in which in terms of China being behind Russia at this moment?
I'm sure just as the West has solidified, there's an incentive for Putin to reinforce the existing formal agreement in which Russia and China participate. At least initially, China can provide liquid capital, but China has its own economic problems. And historically, there has never been close. This is not a special relationship like the Americans and the British. Historically, there's always been tension, conflict, and disagreement between Russia, the Soviet Union, and China since the Communist Revolution in 1949. It's curious. In some ways, the nationalists had more rapport with the Soviet Union than did the Communist Chinese. Their Stalinist practices, Stalinist organization historically were very, very influential and became rooted in the nationalists who opposed the communists, the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek. As usual, it's complicated, but it's not a close natural cultural relationship. Quite the reverse. During the height of the Cold War, 58-59, the famous Sino-Soviet split occurred. Basic clash between, including some sporadic armed fighting at the border between these two giant powers, the Soviet Union and China.
Wow.
Well, no, you're very wise. I think it's very, very important to bring up China, and thank you for doing that.
Right. And, of course, we'll continue to watch this really troubling situation.
Absolutely.
With utmost attention. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, a monthly visitor to The Morning Show. Yes.
Thank you for mentioning my columns, as you always do, and for actually reading them. Mm-hmm. It's something that Tom Clausen in particular, our benefactor and trustee and alum who ran both Bank of America and the World Bank, and I feel I'm being loyal to him at this point, as well as the intellectual discipline, but substantial scholars who are worth reading on this matter in particular include John Mearsheimer, Mearsheimer, at the University of Chicago, whom I respect a lot. I believe his comments on U.S. foreign policy, Russia, and East European, including a current article in the journal Foreign Affairs, as well as his books, easily available, are worth reading in a longer-term sense. Two important scholars, and in one case, diplomat, who are no longer with us, George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N, eminently readable, the father of the containment policy, which got us through the Cold War, and Hans Morgenthau, also at the University of Chicago, through most of his career, a kind of intellectual mentor for Mearsheimer and other realists. These people are worth paying attention to today.
Very good. So it seems almost absurd to move from this pretty frightening situation between Russia and Ukraine to look closer to home to a situation between the United States and our neighbors to the north, Canada, with whom, of course, we have a long and, for the most part, very cordial cooperative relationship, although there certainly have been tensions. I wasn't aware until I read your most recent column about something that has kind of, I don't know if erupted is maybe too strong a term, but between the United States and Canada and a situation in Canada involving many of their truckers and the actions taken by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. For the sake of any other listeners who also were not aware of this interesting story. Could you just sketch the background, please?
Yes. Interprovincial, in our terms, interstate truck drivers have been mounting a long-term protest, which has disrupted trade, in particular related to the auto and vehicle industries, appropriately enough, at our border, in particular going into Michigan. There is a, inspired by them, there's a similar movement underway in the U.S., and we're going to be seeing big convoys of American truck drivers going to the East Coast. I've read that actually the majority of professional truck drivers long distance in Canada are vaccinated, but they're very annoyed by, they've got a tough job anyway. It's a very hard way to make a living, but they're annoyed by more and more government regulations, controls, in the sense of being jerked around by the government. Prime Minister Trudeau, quite unwisely, as I make clear, has, I believe he panicked. He seems to be a very fearful leader at this point. And he declared, in effect, martial law, something that his father did way back around 1970 in very different circumstances. But I don't think, and a lot of other people don't think, that the current circumstances warrant that. And as is often the case, when a coward is in charge and things go wrong, when a coward is in charge of any institution and things go wrong, big trouble results. And our relations have kind of survived. We have a special relationship with the Canadians as well as the British, but it's important to pay attention to this story, especially since the same thing is happening right here down south.
So just to be clear, did I hear you call Justin Trudeau a coward?
Yes.
I mean, in what way is he a coward? I mean, in what way did these actions demonstrate his cowardice?
It's overreaction. He publicly is a man who's very fearful. You don't have to be a psychoanalyst to see that. And I believe his reactions are far beyond what the circumstances warrant. We're not talking about criminal behavior. We're not talking about an insurrection, an overworked word in the U.S. nowadays in the media. It could have been handled without these mass arrests and without the government, as I understand it from the news, punitively freezing individual men, individual families, bank accounts, credit cards. It's really the heavy hand of the state coming down on them in ways that are not warranted.
Wow. So in other words, he panicked at a difficult situation, and in your mind, is making it worse.
No, I don't think I'm engaging in name-calling. Everybody listening should make up their own mind.
Sure.
One reason you and I are here is to be helpful and encourage people to do so. But yeah, no, I'm not name-calling. The term objectively applies to him.
Yeah,
cowardice is a mental and emotional disease that can destroy any institution and organization.
Interesting.
Including a government.
And, of course, the story also underscores something that I think a lot of us have maybe come to a little better awareness of, which is that all of us are incredibly dependent on the men and women who drive trucks across vast distances of our country. And this thing called the supply chain, which gets in trouble, I mean, that they are a vital link in terms of getting us goods that we want and need. And I think a lot of us have not been very mindful of that sort of facet of our society and economy until now.
And apparently, in relative terms, they're becoming even more important. I read in the Wall Street Journal within the last couple of days, scrambling to do homework for this important program, that the proportion of enormous and always growing goods transport in this country, more has been going by truck, is going by truck, relatively less by rail, because it provides greater flexibility in these difficult times to the companies that have to ship.
So we need those truck drivers.
Yeah, it's a source of strength for this region in particular. One of my favorite facts, which actually dates back to my 2 years at the World Trade Center in Chicago before I was fortunate to come to Carthage College. More than half the interstate truck traffic in North America, including our Mexico friends as well as our Canada friends, goes through this immediate region, I-80, 94, 294. in and around the Chicago, Milwaukee, metropolitan corridor. It's one profoundly important reason why we no longer hear our region referred to as the Rust Belt. It's a big factor in the recovery of this area from the industrial decline that occurred starting in the 60s and into the 90s from the tremendous wrenching changes in old-fashioned traditional industrial manufacturing concentrated in the Great Lakes region.
Mm. One last question about this column. Can you explain what the... You point to tension between the United States and Canada over this issue. Can you just clarify what that tension is? I mean, why is this not just a problem in Canada? What does it directly have to do with us, and in what way is it stirring tension between our two countries?
Because it's disrupting the kind of extremely important trade that's already under pressure. Supply chains are already under pressure as a result of the pandemic, which we've now been living with and reacting to for a couple of years. I was referring to that.
I see.
And the fact that this, I know I'm not a voice in the wilderness in criticizing the Canadian Prime Minister. A lot of people in the U.S., we tend to see our Canadian friends as the sane partner overall. We're all fortunate they have not tried to build a wall, I like to say. And they rightly often look askance at the kind of wild, crazy nature of our politics. The Canadians tend to be the good guys in international organizations,
right.
Undeniably. Tremendous public humanitarian service. And for them to have this kind of extreme political behavior is unusual, and it adds to psychological as well as economic frictions and tensions with us south of their border. I think that's what I meant.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and joining us today for his monthly visit to the morning show here on WGTD. Aside from this column about the truckers in Canada, your most recent column just before that was one about inflation. And, of course, anybody who's been to the grocery store or to the gas pump or ordered any kind of goods is well aware that we are suffering from soaring inflation right now. You really issue a word of caution when it comes to the best way to meet this situation, and in your minds, throwing money at it could be a real mistake. Tell us more about kind of the source of your concerns.
Well, inflation, once it becomes rooted, can become very easily self-reinforcing. We went through that in this country with the stagflation of the 1970s. Very heavy fiscal deficits during the Johnson administration. The Vietnam War, as usual, did not go according to, quote, plan, unquote. And President Johnson and Defense Secretary McNamara, unfortunately, did their best to hide the real costs of the war from Congress as well as the American people generally. This, along with the ambitious social spending, the Great Society, of that administration created inflationary pressures. Richard Nixon, that was fiscal policy. Richard Nixon, again, unfortunate leadership in that regard, was so anxious and concerned about re-election in 72 after being narrowly elected, just barely in 68, that he put tremendous pressure on Arthur Burns, the head of the Federal Reserve at the time. Almost unbelievable pressure. It's clear now in documented sources to have a loose monetary policy in the face of this inflation, sort of like us today. And that put in place inflation that became really, truly frightening. An academic by the name of Phillips had, with great confidence in the 50s, published an influential journal article making the case statistically that inflation and unemployment have a direct trade-off, that as inflation goes up, unemployment will go down. This was taken as gospel until it was proven, given that we're dealing with human behavior. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, both went up at the same time. Jimmy Carter deserves a great deal of credit for appointing, who appointed our friend Tom Clawson as head of the World Bank, but nominated Clawson, by the way, it wasn't Reagan. Likewise, Paul Volcker was nominated to head the Fed, and he really broke the back of inflation. These gentlemen served under the Reagan administration in these particular jobs, but it was actually a Jimmy Carter achievement that both of these fine public servants were put in place. But it was extremely painful. Also, it should be emphasized even more, aside from shortcomings by U.S. presidents, in 1973, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, jacked up oil prices, petroleum prices, tremendously, like several hundred percent, and they did it again in 79. We are at real risk, I think, of having the sort of contagion repeat. I don't think that's going to happen, but my track record, I assure you, is in terms of predicting what's going to happen next in the real world, isn't so great.
Right. But So how did Paul Volcker break the back of inflation? I mean, what policies did he help set in place that made such a difference?
The Fed has been loosening the spigot in an unprecedented way over the last couple of years to mitigate the potentially disastrous economic effects of the global pandemic. Paul Volcker tightened monetary policy very, very significantly. He also raised interest rates in ways that finally brought down inflation.
Can you
also, Carter, who was a fiscal conservative, I do believe Jimmy Carter, like George H.W. Bush, will get a fair amount of credit in history that he hasn't been getting during and since his administration. Carter did exercise remarkable fiscal discipline in terms of throttling back on the demand side of the economy through fiscal policy. Excuse me, I think I interrupted you.
So I just wanted you to clarify exactly what you meant when the part about Paul Volcker tightened, what did you say, tightened our monetary policy?
Yes, the Fed.
And what exactly does that mean?
The Fed controls the money supply. It used to be through literally issuing currency. The dollar is now, the dollar is a global currency in a way that the Fed could not directly control, but they can buy securities. They can issue bonds in ways that will mop up dollars that are in circulation. They don't control the money supply directly, as I understand the situation. I don't believe even highly qualified professional economists fully understand everything that's going on in the economy. Hmm. But in the 60s and 70s, you could directly control the money supply. Today, it's much more a matter of buying and selling financial instruments in ways that will reduce or expand the amount of currency in circulation. Is that a clear point?
Yeah, that clear.
Well, good.
And it's
like I tell our fine students, anytime I'm not clear, let me know right away. You get extra credit, and I don't want to be the last to know at this point.
So. Right. And so, and in a sense, this is in sharp contrast to what you talk about in the column in terms of Germany in the 1920s, where in a difficult situation, their response to it was to print up more and more and more and more money. I mean, literally printing up currency to the point where it became all but worthless by 1923.
Yes, indeed. And it was a dramatic example of fear itself. German leaders, they were faced with, from the Allies who won the war, they were faced with reparations, demands, and obligations that were put down on paper that they couldn't possibly meet. The economy was in a shambles. The German army was intact at the end of World War I. It was the economy and the society that collapsed. The French intervened quite ruthlessly and unwisely in the Ruhr industrial area, further weakening the economy. And they simply started printing money. It was a case of panic at the top, fear itself taking over. I believe there is a lot of historical evidence, including public opinion surveys that the U.S. Army quite farsightedly did right after our victory in World War II in Germany, that indicate past, present, a collective difficulty in handling uncertainty, a collective need for security, which led to the election. They didn't just take over the election of the Nazi Party in the early 1930s, and the appointment of Adolf Hitler as chancellor, and the rest, alas, is history.
Right. It was fueled by a very real fear among the populace.
Yes, that was the classic a book that became quite popular, The End of Money, in 1975. It was published. It remained in obscurity until in the aftermath of the financial crash of 07, 08, and 2010. The Daily Telegraph in Britain said this was one of Warren Buffett's favorite books, and it immediately shot up to the top of the Amazon bestseller list in the United Kingdom. Warren Buffett was contacted by a reporter, and he mentioned this later in a TV interview and said, no, I've never heard of the book. I also mentioned E.F. Hutton and their efforts to be like Warren Buffett back during the aftermath of that financial crash. E.F. Hutton has disappeared today because they were convicted of fraud and disappeared. But back in the 1980s, E.F. Hutton says, and then a whole room full of people, a cocktail party, a large gathering, a convention, everybody would become silent to listen to what E.F. Hutton had to say.
Yes, when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. Yeah.
Really get hard information, not just about the economy, but Ukraine. Do your best to get hard information. And I think our intelligence agencies and President Biden deserve a great deal of credit, along with other Western allies, because intelligence agencies have been pretty accurate in analyzing and predicting what Putin was going to do, and we should feel some reassurance from that.
Right.
And our leaders have been pretty public. The game, I mentioned Vietnam, the game playing that went on then, and the obvious deception by arrogant leaders, that doesn't seem to be the case today.
Right. One last question stemming from this column. You write at one point, simply injecting funds into an unstable economy without essential reforms is a recipe for failure. Do you have particular essential reforms in mind when you write those words?
Well, I was referring more to Germany
and
not so much the contemporary situation. I actually believe the Fed has done remarkably well. They've been quite daring, which is appropriate in our wealthy nation. And I think that this very expansive set of policies has, in fact, averted much greater dislocation and real suffering for Americans, especially working people, low-income people. No, I think these public policies have been very wise, right up there with the New Deal, in my opinion, in a much tougher time.
Very good.
But just injecting money is not the solution.
Right.
And Germany is an object lesson.
For sure. To finish out, you wrote a really interesting column about the Electoral College.
Ah, yes.
And this stemmed from what I'm sure a lot of our listeners are aware of, some public statement that was made by former Vice President Mike Pence, who, of course, was right at the heart of that kind of scary moment in terms of certifying the most recent election that saw the victory of Joe Biden over incumbent Donald Trump. And Mike Pence really spelled it out clearly what he felt his role was in this kind of complicated situation with the Electoral College and how Congress is part of that process. And I think you did a great job in this column of kind of explaining why our founders, our founding fathers, why they set up a system that is as complicated as it is. Explain to our listeners what the purpose was or the concerns that were at the heart of their decision to set up not just kind of our overall government, but really specifically this matter of our presidential elections and why it is this kind of intricate apparatus.
They had particular fear, understandably, of concentrations of power in the immediate aftermath of the American Revolution. Initially, when the colonies declared independence in 1776, we had something called the Articles of Confederation, which the Confederate States of America basically tried to reproduce during our Civil War. They didn't work. So the Constitutional Convention, after we won the Revolution in 1787, spent weeks hammering out a constitution. But the reason why Washington is a real mess is that all the time there was no concentrated authority by design. They were very, very fearful. They debated for a long time about having the president picked by Parliament, a la the British and parliamentary practice generally. They decided that would be too dangerous. So they purposely had our three branches of government that are forced to cooperate but have separate, independent authority of their own by design. We also have a federal system where constitutionally, if it's not an established part of the national government, it devolves to the states. They were afraid of the concentration of authority represented by mob rule or popular sentiment generally, and they did their best to dilute it. You and I, voters, do not elect the president directly. The Electoral College, this strange, complicated contraption in each state, actually elects the president. And then the Vice President of the United States confirms all the electoral votes that go to Washington. Donald Trump has been utterly irresponsible since the 2020 election. The demonstrably false charge that the election was somehow stolen. And this contributed directly to the riot in January 6th in the Capitol. And Mike Pence's very courageous statements, which I emphasize in the article about how the election is not stolen, and the Electoral College is our central institution for election. I hope that's clear. There was a big debate in the 1950s. Unlike today, there was a very serious debate and movement to abolish the Electoral College that proceeded throughout the 50s. And interestingly enough, John Kennedy, freshman senator from Massachusetts, was extremely active in this debate and a leader in this debate. And I quote snippets from the very extensive commentary, which are worth reading if you really want to learn about the subject and a very serious effort to change it. We have a constitutional amendment traveling through our states now, but we don't have a serious discussion of the matter in the way that we did back then. I commend that to our listeners. It's a good civics lesson.
Right.
And Kennedy, who was not a leader in the Senate, was seized by the subject and made some very, very perceptive comments about it.
Right. And, of course, I think one of your parting comments in that column is in a sense, says, beware of simplistic answers to something that, might be a source of frustration, because there's a reason why all of this is complicated.
Yes.
And to kind of take that away could do really serious and lasting harm to our government as a whole and our nation as a whole.
If you look at a map of the U.S. today, geographically, it's Trump country. Outside of the metropolitan areas, which are blue, Democratic Party and the current colors, the rest of the country is red, Republican. The founders were very much conscious of geography and structures beyond one person, one vote. And, of course, the franchise was much limited to males with property. Not all white males, but males who were free and had property, were not slaves or indentured servants. We have changed and transformed dramatically for the better, but the institutions have survived because I believe they put in place institutions that were subject to change.
Hmm.
In a rather brief document, there are failed states and disappeared dictatorships and corrupt countries that have constitutions that are hundreds of pages long. Our document is actually quite brief, and it's accommodated all this tremendous change.
That's pretty amazing. It really
is. It is. I think we owe the founders a vote of thanks. They don't get it often in academia today, but for that reason, I think we should all think about this.
Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, once again, it's been great to have you here on the morning show and to have a interesting and wide-ranging conversation about some really important topics. I really appreciate you making time in your schedule to be part of the morning show and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Well, you're always very generous. Thank you. And when it's not so great, why, please let me know right away.
Always good to have you here. Thank you so much. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be